Wine and Spirits, 1115 West Windsor Road in Champaign, with an international selection of wines, beers, and spirits, and a full-service gourmet deli with customized deli platters and gift baskets. More information on the web at sunsingerwines.com.
This is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about human rights and also about the work of Amnesty International. And our guest for the program is Kurt Gehring. He is the Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International USA and well-known as a human rights activist. He's been involved with Amnesty for over 20 years. He is the Chief Operating Officer of Amnesty USA. His responsibilities include policy and strategy development, public representation, and also fundraising. He's been involved in many research assignments as well in the field for Amnesty in the Middle East, in Africa, in Europe, and in Asia. At the end of the week, on Saturday, he's going to be here in our area in central Illinois at the Mennonite Church of Normal, and he will be giving a couple of presentations at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning on the death penalty, and then 7 o'clock in the evening, Human Rights and Wrongs in an Age of Terror. And this is an event that is open to anyone that would like to attend. I'm sure the folks there at the Mennonite Church of Normal, which is at 805 South Cottage Avenue, would welcome people. There is a luncheon associated with this, and they are asking that if you want to have the lunch, there's a small donation, and also ask that you make a reservation. So the number that to do that is 452-6622. Otherwise, if people are interested just in coming and hearing Kurt Gehring talk, they are welcome to do that. Here on the program, questions, comments are welcome too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana, wherever the signal will travel. As a matter of fact, for people who are listening on the internet, you can also use the toll-free line. So no matter where you are, as long as you're in the United States, listening on the internet, you can use the toll-free. That is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have that toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Mr. Gehring, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Sure. Good to be with you.
You know, I came across a newspaper article, this now goes back several years, that was referred to a survey that was done. This was in 1997, and it was done to, in part, to mark the anniversary, the 50-year anniversary of the adoption of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And Amnesty was one of the organizations that was involved in commissioning this study. And in this particular story, you were quoted making some comments about it. And what they did was they went out and they asked people, had they experienced discrimination? And they found, among other things, 49% of adults, this was in 1997, 49% of adults said that they had personally experienced discrimination. 52% said that America has a very or fairly serious problem when it comes to human rights. And among those surveyed, 63% said poor people face discrimination, 61% said disabled people face discrimination, 41% say black people are routinely discriminated against. So this is... And you're quoted in the story as saying that 50 years after the Declaration of Human Rights was adopted, the statistics are numbing. Well, now, here we are, 2005. How do you think we're doing today?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think we're doing much better. And 60 years after the UN was founded, we have to add to those statistics from 10 years ago. Now, all those related to abuses associated with the so-called war on terror, and that's added a whole new layer of very serious violations, which we weren't addressing in the same kind of way 10 years ago. And I think one of the remarkable things about this last period, these last 4 years, has been the role that our own government has played with respect to human rights protections or human rights abuses during this period. We've liked to think of our own government as a leader and promoter of human rights around the world, and indeed our own government, was very instrumental in getting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights through the United Nations. It was a leading proponent. Eleanor Roosevelt played a very strong role in that. And subsequent to that, with the various international covenants and human rights treaties, most of them, the U.S. played a very strong role in that. And unfortunately now, over the last 4 years, since the attacks from September 11, as the U.S. has struggled with trying to address its security concerns and balance those with human rights issues, that balance, unfortunately, has fallen out of whack. And the U.S., we see as being at the forefront of a rollback in human rights protections, which has larger worldwide implications.
Mm-hmm. Well, and obviously there have been real concerns raised about things like how detainees have been treated in Guantanamo Bay, for example, how people who've been held by the United States in other places have been treated in Iraq, in Afghanistan. There have been concerns about what's called, I believe the phrase is extrajudicial rendition, where you take somebody who's had been held in the United States and you send them somewhere else and you engage in torture by proxy. We know these things happen because they're documented even in the mainstream media. So the question is, well, is that some sort of aberration? Or is that more widespread and is sanctioned at a level of government that would really disturb us if we knew how that happened? The response often by people in government is, well, yes, things like that happen, but it happens at a low level. It's bad people doing bad things because they just took it upon themselves to do that, not because someone at some high level of government said, this is the kind of thing that we have to engage in to make sure that we're protecting the security of the United States.
Well, you're absolutely right. All those issues that you mentioned are a very serious concern to Amnesty. And with respect to extraordinary renditions, for example, it is really impossible at this stage to know, because it's such a secretive process, how widespread that is. The information that we're beginning to gather, and we're trying to do this by sending teams around the world where people who have been renditioned might have been released or might still be held in prisons in different places, and interview them to try to find out whatever pieces of information we can get from them to try to piece together how widespread this practice is. In a few days, we'll be releasing a report about with some of our conclusions about some of these cases, and that will indicate that, or suggest that, the practice might be more comprehensive, more organized, and more widespread than previously known. And it is probably not only being used against so-called high-value detainees. These would be those who are senior al-Qaeda people or even second-tier people, but some people who probably have nothing whatsoever to do with acts of terror, being picked up in different countries around the world and brought to different secret locations. And this is very problematic and disturbing in itself, because they're not being held. No one knows exactly where they're being held. There have been reports about different places, many different places in the Middle East, from Egypt to Jordan to Morocco to the Indian island of Diego Garcia, where there's a British base, U.S. Ships in the Indian Ocean, and the reports in yesterday's Washington Post, although it didn't mention the specific countries, noted for the first time that there are probably a couple of places in Eastern European democracies where prisoners are now being held. So on that particular issue, it's impossible, because of the secretive nature of this, to know how widespread it is. We do know far more about Guantanamo Bay, which of course isn't a secret location, but to which access is very restricted. The International Committee of the Red Cross is the only international organization that has access, and even the way they operate, which is agreeing to go in by making whatever concerns they might have convey those privately to the government before going public, and only very rarely go public, and only do so when they feel their private representations have gotten essentially nowhere. The Red Cross has complained that the treatment of prisoners there is tantamount to torture. And the issue of 500 people, some of them held now for 4 years in this legal black hole, without charges against them, without any trial on the horizon, held indefinitely, without being given an opportunity to see what evidence the government might have against them, or any opportunity to refute that evidence. This kind of legal black hole is extremely disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in response to this story, that as you mentioned, it was broken, I think, in the Post, the Washington Post, and there was a story in the New York Times, and I'm sure in a lot of other papers, that the CIA was using this secret Soviet-era compound, in the words of the AP here, in Eastern Europe to house and to interrogate important high-level al-Qaeda people. In response, the National Security Advisor to the President, Stephen Hadley, first of all said, well, he wouldn't either confirm or deny that such a thing existed, but then he went on to say he said, while we have to do what's necessary to defend the country against terrorist attacks and win the war on terror, the president has been very clear that we're going to do that in a way that is consistent with our values. And he goes on to say, that's why he's been very clear the United States will not torture. The United States will conduct its activities in compliance with law and international obligations. Do you draw any comfort from a statement like that?
No, none at all. I mean, the rhetoric from this administration is very mixed. On the one hand, we have these kinds of statements where the rhetoric in and of itself is good. The reality, however, is that the vice president, who presumably also speaks for the administration and represents government policy, has in the last week been making the rounds within the U.S. Senate, urging the Senate to legally pass or to pass legislation which would legally allow the CIA to be exempt from U.S. anti-torture laws, so that they would, in effect, be legally allowed to torture. Senator McCain was, of course, the author of an amendment to the appropriations bill, the amendment regulates for all agencies, including the CIA, that prisoners be treated humanely in accordance with the Convention Against Torture, which the United States has signed and ratified. And that passed overwhelmingly by a vote of 90-9 in the Senate. And it was after that that the vice president went to see McCain, tried to urge him to withdraw that provision, went around meeting with other senators, urging them to vote against it. So, and there have been newspaper articles and editorials entitled "A Vice President for Torture," because in effect, the vice president Cheney was advocating that the U.S. be legally allowed to torture, and urging the Senate and Congress more broadly to give them that authority. So no, this rhetoric, which is designed to reassure us, isn't reassuring at all.
Yeah. And I think it's worth underlining, as you have, that these concerns have not, and this is not a partisan thing necessarily. It's not Republican versus Democrat. It's not left versus right, where you have someone who indeed is not particularly considered to be a liberal, or and certainly is not a Democrat. That is John McCain, who is raising the issue, and other Republicans have too. So this is something that is even within Republican ranks is causing a lot of division.
That's right, and that's an excellent point, because the leaders in this particular fight to introduce the anti-torture amendment were Republicans. Democrats were supportive, but they didn't lead the effort. this was led by McCain, and as you mentioned, there was strong support from the Republicans as well as the Democrats. But the Democrats didn't lead this last particular effort.
Hmm. We have a caller. We'd welcome others into the conversation. The guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Kurt Gehring. He is the Senior Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, and will be here in Central Illinois at the end of the week on Saturday in Normal. He'll be giving a couple of talks at the Mennonite Church of Normal, and they are open to anybody who would like to attend. Folks there at the church say that you should feel welcome if you'd like to hear Kurt Gehring. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have caller to start us off in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Certainly from the press and the TV news and radio news, we know that we've sent people to countries that practice torture on their own people. And it seems rather obvious that, you know, this was a way to get around certain beliefs, or rather strong beliefs, I guess, and certain laws in the United States, and which is usually followed by some sort of commentary by the person saying that, well, we all know that under torture anybody will say anything. And in some sense, you know, it seems, you know, sort of strange way, unless you just want to make sure somebody says something so that you can actually do something to them legally. I was wondering if you could speak to two things. One, this sort of breakdown of morality. I remember as a young child, we were, you know, in the movies in particular, were told to hiss the Japs and the Nazis because they tortured people and, you know, in a sense, weren't fair, however that may play out. And now we're asked to accept those kinds of things. And it's, you know, it's almost a form of cognitive dissonance. You know, when the first time I heard it, I couldn't actually, you know, I thought somebody's messed up here. But, of course, now we know that it's true. The next question deals with, you mentioned the Russian place. I know the Russians would use very high-tech times of psychological things to get people to break down. I was wondering if Amnesty has any information about that sort of thing. You know, there's torture and then there's torture. I was wondering if you could speak to that. Another nice program, David.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Well, Mr. Gehring?
Yes, on the first question, it is of enormous concern that the administration at the highest levels, again, despite the rhetoric of the president and some of the spokespeople, that senior officials have authorized specific kinds of treatment. Donald Rumsfeld, for example, signed memos in which he authorized what were called stress and duress techniques, but included sleep deprivation, hooding of prisoners, forced nudity, the use of dogs, this kind of thing. The legal memorandum out of the White House, which tried to establish the legal case for how certain types of interrogations could take place within interpretations of the law that wouldn't have people later face charges of war crimes. You know, the signals that sends to the confusion that emanates out from official agencies down to the private level, or the soldiers who, by all accounts, were very confused about what the limits were. So, you know, your point about morality was that the signal sent at the highest levels were enormously confusing. They were being revised, and so far the investigations that have, and of which there have been, you know, more than a dozen, which have looked into the scandal at Abu Ghraib and how did that happen and who is responsible, those have had limited purview, and they've only been authorized to look down the chain of command, not up the chain of command. So one of the things Amnesty and many other human rights groups are calling for, as well as representatives and senators in Congress, is the establishment of a commission of investigation to determine exactly how this happened and who is responsible. There's so much information that's already known that's available, but we really do need an independent commission to establish the facts and make recommendations for how this can be prevented in the future, and also that persons responsible, not only down the chain, but up the chain of command, are held accountable. On the second question, with respect to the former Soviet Union, yes, you're absolutely correct that during the period the Soviet Union was in existence, we were monitoring human rights conditions there as best we could, even though the Soviets didn't allow amnesty in. But there was significant information available about their use, for example, of psychiatric hospitals for political purposes, where dissidents would be, for speaking out against the regime or writing an article critical of the regime or the system, would be sent to psychiatric institutions for treatment as one of the ways they dealt with these individuals. Others, of course, were sent to labor colonies, and there were, you know, there was major sustained crackdown on virtually all kinds of dissent. And now, one of the things that's particularly disturbing about these latest revelations, even though we don't know the details of the treatment inside these locations, we're beginning to get in some information about where those locations might actually be. But of course, given the history of abuse in some of these places, if these are the same places, what does that portend for these prisoners who are being renditioned there?
We are just about at a midpoint. I have another caller I want to get right to. Let me just, though, introduce again our guest, Kurt Gehring. He's the deputy director of Amnesty International USA, has been involved with Amnesty now for over 20 years. His responsibilities include policy and strategy development and public representation. He's also carried out many research assignments in the field for Amnesty International in the Middle East, in Africa, in Europe, and in Asia. If you're interested, by the way, in finding out more about Amnesty USA, and you have access to the Internet, they have a website with a lot of information there, and the web address is pretty easy. It's www.amnestyusa.org, and you can learn more about it. Also, I do want to mention again that our guest, Kurt Gehring, will be speaking at the Mennonite Church of Normal this coming weekend on Saturday, talking about two things, talking about the death penalty in the morning at 10, and then at 7 o'clock in the evening, more broadly on human rights and wrongs in an age of terror. There is no charge for the talks. There is a lunch, and they're looking for a donation for the lunch. 452-6622 is the number. They're just asking people to register if they're going to do that. Questions, comments are certainly welcome here on the program. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller in Champaign County, and it's line one. Hello.
Thank you, Dave. I'd like to emphasize that last point you made about makes the remark about Gulag, which is an analogy, but it gives it a little extra pungency, I guess, the fact that the Romanian prison was likely one that the KGB was using, and it's been repurposed by the Bush administration and the CIA and whomever else, military intelligence, that are doing these things. But I wanted to actually make a broader historical point here, too. This isn't all just since 9/11. With Bush down in Latin America, one doesn't have to go very far back into Amnesty International archives to know that the U.S. was participating in torture in Latin America. Extraordinary rendition started under the Clinton administration, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing I wanted to ask about, and I don't know if you are professionally a lawyer, but I just heard it asserted on a Washington talk show where they were treating this issue, that there is no international law that prevents a disappearance, basically. I mean, people always go fall back and attack the Geneva Conventions when the torture treaty is really the one that, you know, that gets forgotten, and we don't have to do Geneva against these people because they're not from a state. But I just heard it asserted that there's no international law of any kind that stops the U.S. from picking somebody up just because they want to, it seems. And I just seems like that's, you know, there must be some way. I mean, maybe there's no operant law, but you know, it's obviously flies entirely in the face of human rights. I'm getting a sputter here because I'm getting excited about this, but I'd like for you to treat some of those issues, and I guess I'll hang around. Thank you.
All right. Well, Mr. Gary?
Yeah, no, there's a whole battery of laws, which international laws, human rights standards, which prevent or which make illegal disappearances. And it begins with the penal codes in most countries. But there are also very strong international standards that are broadly endorsed, ratified by most countries of the world. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, for example, doesn't allow persons to be taken into custody and then simply being disappeared. People have to be faced with the evidence against them, being given an opportunity to refute them. They can't be held indefinitely without being charged or without being tried. Now, there are some provisions in states of emergency where there is a real emergency, where people can be held without charge or trial for specific periods, but it's not intended to go on for decades or years. In Syria, for example, there's been a state of emergency now, I think, for 43 years, and they have been holding prisoners without charge, without trial, under that state of emergency legislation. Now, even though Syria has signed and ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and they are exempting themselves as there's a procedure to do under the law, it's a complete abuse of that standard, which they have committed themselves to abide by and uphold. Now, I only use that as one example, because the Geneva Conventions, as you suggested as well, don't allow a person to be taken into custody and held off the books. And this is particularly pertinent in the case of the Guantanamo Bay prisoners or other centers where the U.S. is holding people, because the Secretary of Defense has acknowledged holding off the books at least one prisoner and probably others, so the International Committee of the Red Cross won't have access to that individual. Now, there's no legal cover that anyone can use to justify that, and that's why they're using these secret locations outside. Why it's such a secretive process, so that they're held outside any kind of law that might apply, national law, domestic law, but the international standards, they still do apply.
Thanks for that clarification. There are quite a few provisions of the Geneva Conventions. Not all of them apply to a uniformed military from a recognized state. So, I mean, I think there's some provision for military some kind of tribunal in any event. But I wanted to also clarify, I think you pointed out to it but didn't mention it, that this McCain statute or amendment to the defense authorization is almost identical to the one that Dick Durbin here from Illinois presented last year. And at that time, Condi Rice delivered a letter and asked them. It was passed again with more than 90 senators voting in favor of it, and then it was taken out in conference, I believe, or maybe even by the Senate after Condi Rice brought a letter asking for it to be taken out entirely. Now, apparently, they're just trying to exempt the CIA. But, I mean, it's clear. I wanted to make that point, that Durbin actually. And then he was also attacked for making a bad analogy, apparently. And I think that was part of the campaign to make sure that he didn't have the temerity to offer a similar statute again. And it's good that McCain, as you say, has offered it again. Thank you.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Durbin played a very important role on many of these issues and has been and continues to. The ultimate disposition of this McCain amendment is still uncertain because, of course, it goes to the House now to conference to see if they can get support in the House for something similar. So even though the Senate is now on record with what they've voted, and it's a very good amendment, it's still unclear whether it's going to pass the House or in what form. But what's even more outrageous about this is that the president has said that if it reaches his desk, he'll veto the entire defense authorization bill. He'll veto because of this anti-torture provision. Now this will be the first thing that the president has vetoed in 5 years, and to have that veto be registered because of an anti-torture provision, it raises really profound questions.
Hmm. Well, let me go and take the opposing point of view here, and I'm sure that you have heard the argument, and then people will make the argument that said, look, what we're talking about here are individuals who are out to do great harm to the United States. And if we have someone and we suspect that they're involved in terrorism or a terrorist organization, we need to know everything that they know about the organization, how it is put together, who's in it, what they're planning on doing, and that thereby prevent future acts of terrorism. This is a vital matter of the security, the lives and property of Americans, either in this country or elsewhere. And that if you tie our hands by saying that there are certain things that we cannot do to extract information, then we're not going to be able to get the information that we need. We're not going to be able to take down these networks. We're not going to be able to stop acts of terrorism, and that we need to do whatever it takes to get that information.
Well, we need to do whatever it takes within the boundaries of the law. I mean, we are, after all, a country, or should be, that abides by the rule of law. We've long promoted standards relating to the rule of law, and there is a serious problem of terrorism in the world, and governments have the role and indeed the obligation, the responsibility to protect citizens from acts of terror. That's absolutely a central role and a purpose of government. But the way in which that is done has to be within the boundaries of the law. It doesn't mean that there are no longer any standards, that there is no longer any laws that apply. Because as soon as we begin to say anything goes in trying to win this war, then what kind of values are we defending in the end anyhow? Not only that, but when we take these kinds of measures, and our own soldiers or our own citizens or personnel are captured abroad by armies or armed groups or others, and they see how the U.S. has been treating its captured prisoners, and there's no respect for the Geneva Conventions or the standards for holding prisoners of war, then why should our captured people be held any differently? So it is important that the government do what it can to protect our society and our people, but it has to do so in a manner that respects the fundamental human rights. I mean, after all, what we're talking about here is torture, the right not to be disappeared, the right not to be held indefinitely without charge or trial, without knowing why you're there. These are central, fundamental, basic human rights issues.
Let's take another call. Urbana is the place here, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, it seems as if it's exactly where we step off and start rounding up suspects that we have to stop and acknowledge that we're extremely rich country, and we have a lot of capability to, and we've never even tried to exhaust our ability to understand the grievances we may have committed on people around the world. And so it's very depressing to think about the way we go about things. But I was going to ask you about this International Covenant on Civil and Human Rights. I believe that's the title you gave.
Yes, civil and political rights. Yeah,
civil and political rights. Okay. Yeah, I was I was trying to see if there's anything that could rise to the level of a quote treaty unquote that could be cited in order to engage the Supreme Court on Article 6 of the Constitution, where we're told that our treaties, our international treaties, is supposedly the supreme law of the land. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that and whether or not this international covenant might rise to the level of a treaty that might put that clause into effect.
Well, yeah, it's a very good question. And the I should note that the United States is a signatory and has ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but it has done so with some reservations. And one of those reservations is that, and when I say reservations, it with certain exceptions, with certain understandings and certain declarations. And one of those being that nothing in that covenant is understood to supersede the U.S. Constitution. So in effect, they have in the Senate, as they went through the process of ratifying that treaty, they gutted some of the most important provisions of it. And this is one of the treaties that the U.S. has ratified. There are so many others, very important ones, central to the human rights legal regime, which the U.S. has not either signed or ratified. The most egregious example of undermining, I think, international human rights standards might be the statute of the International Criminal Court, which the Clinton administration signed in the on the very last day they were in office. And then that statute was unsigned by the Bush administration. So it was signed, now it's unsigned, so it hasn't been ratified. But there are a whole series, like the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the U.S. has signed but not ratified. And we're really the only government in the world that has not ratified that particular convention. Somalia hasn't ratified it, but it's not a functioning government anymore, so there's not even a process for ratification there. But every other country has. But not only these, the landmines treaty, walking away from the Kyoto treaty, the anti-ballistic treaty. So this administration, in its drive towards not wanting any kind of anything to restrict its flexibility of action. It doesn't want to be hampered by any international standards to do what it wants to do. And what that has set in motion around the world, and why the measures that this administration has taken in the war on terror are so damaging, is because many other governments now see that and they say, well, if the world's leading power, the world's leading democracy, can ignore these international human rights standards, then certainly we can. And we see heads of state that are explicitly referencing what the U.S. has done in order to justify their own clampdowns.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. We have about 13 minutes left on the program. Our guest is Kurt Gehring. He is the Deputy Director of Amnesty International USA, and we're talking about human rights. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How does Amnesty go about trying to gather information on the kinds of things that we have talked about, and how do you deal with the fact that indeed it is secret? We really don't know, and the government's not going to be forthcoming about who they have and where they are and what they're doing with these people.
Yeah, it makes information gathering on some of these kinds of issues extremely difficult and a very painstaking process. There's probably not one that is more difficult than extraordinary renditions because of the secretive nature of the process. The names of the people aren't available. The places where people might be held, none of that is some of it is known, but it's not from official sources. So what we have to do to try to figure out or get a better idea of what's happening with that process is to track down individuals who have been through that process, who might be willing to speak, who we would interview in great length. We just had a delegation return from Yemen speaking to two individuals, actually three individuals, who are still in Yemeni prisons where we had access to them, who had been through this rendition process. Of course, they were blindfolded and held underground. They were taken aboard helicopters and planes at different places. So, you know, at different times and places, they didn't know exactly, where they were. But through extensive, very lengthy interviews with these people individually, you know, there were certain things that began to emerge, certain pieces of information, which, because it's so secretive, any minor detail it can be relevant. We'll soon be sending a delegation to Afghanistan for similar purposes, to see if we can locate persons who were renditioned, who are no longer held, or who might be still held in Afghan prisons, but to whom we might have access, and interview them extensively. Most of the people that have been picked up in this war on terror have come from Afghanistan or Iraq now or Pakistan, but they've also included countries like Bosnia or Croatia or Gambia. One of the cases in this report we'll be releasing in the next few days on renditions is an individual, a Yemeni, but who was picked up in Tanzania, who, according to the information we have, had absolutely nothing to do with war on terror issues. So there's part of this system is that there are it's a worldwide system now where people are being picked up in many different countries, transferred to these secret locations in different places, and the numbers and exactly who they are and why they're held is just not known. No doubt some of them are more senior al-Qaeda figures, but again, as I mentioned at the earlier on, the fear is that this extraordinary renditions program, and sometimes it's a reverse rendition where people are captured abroad and brought to Guantanamo Bay, it's not the scale, the scope, the how comprehensive that is it gives rise, the information gives rise to that it might be much larger than previously understood.
Well, this, you know, I have used this term and you have used this term. It is something that has appeared in the media recently. Apparently, rendition is not a new technique used by the government. Goes back to some time, but I imagine for some people that the phrase will be new.
Yeah.
And maybe we should just explain what we're talking about here is that people who are suspected of crimes, and particularly now recently it has been terrorism, could be people who were apprehended by the United States, maybe in the United States, but probably in some other place, taken to yet another country, a third country, where they are interrogated, and where apparently those people aren't hesitant about using torture. And it is something, as I said, apparently the CIA started doing this back in the 90s, although I think it was just maybe the first time that I found myself hearing this phrase or reading in a story was perhaps within the last year or so.
Yeah, and one of your earlier callers was absolutely correct to point out that this didn't start with the Bush administration, but what did happen is that this program of what some have called outsourcing of torture has really expanded quite considerably under a secret directive that was signed by President Bush in late September 2001 after the attacks. And it's been now estimated that the CIA has been using these planes from these front companies, which really are fictional, and has flown hundreds of suspects to countries where a record of torture has been long established. Egypt, Jordan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Syria. You know, and it's people sometimes who are picked up in airports. The Canadian citizen Maher Arar was picked up here in New York and sent to first to Jordan and then to Syria. You know, he was, you know, wasn't engaged in anything other than traveling at the moment at the time he was picked up, and ended up spending nearly a year in Syria. He's back in Canada now, but the treatment that he experienced at the hands of the Syrians after having been renditioned was horrendous.
Well, that raises a question, and I would not want to suggest that somehow that would make torture appropriate if someone was actually guilty of terrorism, but that raises the question, how many people who have been renditioned, and it may be difficult to answer this question because we actually don't even know how many people have been renditioned, but how many of those people do you think, in fact, were not guilty of anything?
It's really impossible to know. The best, I think, that we can do is to try to find out as much information as we can and see what that information suggests. And that's why this report that we're about to release, even though it focuses on the experiences of only three individuals, the information gathered doesn't suggest that these were in any way mid or senior level Al-Qaeda operatives. And so you're able to understand that at least there are some people who probably have nothing whatsoever to do with terrorist-related activities get caught up in this kind of system. But even for those who are, the prohibition on torture is an absolute one. And even if you're convicted of having masterminded the September 11 attacks, I mean, certainly there are provisions. Those were crimes against humanity. There are provisions under many, many different scenarios to bring those individuals to justice and put them away. But you don't need to resort to illegal techniques. Again, governments have the responsibility to protect citizens and to hold perpetrators accountable. But they don't have license to do whatever they wish.
The stories of detainee abuse that came out of Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, people raise questions about Guantanamo, people raise questions about what might be happening in Afghanistan. In an interesting way also, in maybe not to the extent, but an interesting way also started people raising questions about how people who are in prison in the United States, not for terrorism, but for other crimes, for street crimes, are treated, and how life in American prisons might be, to a greater extent than we would like to admit, maybe not all that much different. And I wonder to what extent that has led Amnesty. I'm sure this is conditions in prisons are something that in the United States are something that Amnesty has been interested in for a long time, and also has taken a very strong stand against capital punishment. But whether that has caused an even somehow greater interest in looking at conditions for people who are in jail in the United States.
Yeah, that issue has been the treatment and conditions of prisons here in the U.S. has been a concern of ours for many, many years, and especially as the prison population grew so dramatically and continues, the building of prisons, the super maximum security institutions in which some of these are held, the issue of private prisons and what standards are private prisons being held to, the electric shock technology that's being introduced in very rapidly throughout the prison system as some of the correctional systems try to cope with cost controls, and one of the ways they do that is by cutting staff, but by equipping their personnel with what can only be described as electric shock weapons. And we've seen the use and the results of the use of this weaponry inside prison, where people are shocked with, prisoners are shocked with, you know, with stun guns or tasers or electronic riot shields, or you know, that kind of use of that kind of weaponry in situations really where it's not consistent with the guidelines and the circumstances under which it might be appropriate to use that kind of equipment. Mm-hmm. So the conditions within many prisons and interestingly enough in some of these, the Jenna prison in Louisiana and the Templesman prison in New Orleans, which had been in the news at post Katrina, were places where Amnesty had raised some very serious concerns about the conditions and treatment of prisoners, including juvenile prisoners in those jails. Many years ago, and even in the case of the Jenna prison, the Supreme Court stepped in and said, you know, these conditions are so bad, something has to happen here. So you're absolutely right. The because the U.S. has so many prisoners, by far the largest per capita imprisonment anywhere in the world. The abuse in some of those prisons, Pelican Bay in California would be another one, has been the subject of concern. Unfortunately, it's been difficult to monitor adequately because there are so many and because the numbers are so large, what's going on nationwide, but it is a focus of ours and remains one.
We are going to have to stop there. We're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Kurt Gehring, is Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. If you want to learn more about the organization, you can go to their website, which is amnestyusa.org. Mr. Gehring, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
The broadcast today made possible by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, other fine pianos. The show also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Funds also come from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series at 4 o'clock on Thursday, today, in the auditorium of the Beckman Center of the U of I campus. The Illinois Geological Survey presenting a public lecture titled The Secret Search for Diamonds in North America by award-winning science journalist Kevin Krajcik. That's it for us. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine. The host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with one of the editors of this collection, Women's Letters.